Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And boom, just like that, the European debt problem is a crisis. Again, crazy how that happens, isn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 18th of March. Good to have you with us. It is, Google tells me, 5,472 miles from Nicosia, Cyprus to the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan. And we are, to be sure, a long ways away from us feeling the after effects of this weekend's bailout of one of the European Union's smallest economies. But still, for a plan that was supposed to keep the European debt crisis safely on the back burner, didn't work out so well, did it? From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains why.
For the first time since the euro crisis began, it's depositors who've been asked to bail out the banks where they save, not the bondholders or the equity investors. Anyone with cash in a bank account in Cyprus could now lose up to 10% of it as a one-off tax. That sent shockwaves through financial markets with good reason, says analyst Louise Cooper.
That sends a scary message to all other Europeans that your savings are not necessarily safe in a bank. What this risks is bank runs.
But the Germans in particular insisted that depositors take a haircut. They say up to half the cash swilling around the Cypriot banking system comes from wealthy Russians. Why should German taxpayers bail them out? Rupert Ruperel of the Open Europe think tank.
I think it really marks a shift in the Eurozone crisis, showing that Germany is no longer willing to put unlimited bailout cash on the line. They weren't willing to put the money on the line to bail out these Russian depositors.
And they have a point, says economist Andrew Hilton. The Germans believe that many of the Russian depositors are recycling ill-gotten gains.
They feel that Cyprus had become a sort of money laundering machine for dodgy Russian money and that Cyprus must pay.
But Cyprus can only be pushed so far by its European partners. Its bank liabilities are more than seven times the size of its economy. It could easily default and crash out of the Eurozone with unpredictable consequences. The Cypriot Parliament votes tomorrow on the bailout plan. Further ructions are likely. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Imagine you wake up in Nicosia Saturday morning. You take a quick look at the headlines and you realize you're about to have three, six, maybe 10% less money in the bank. That's pretty much what happened to 70-year-old Andreas Moiseos. He's a pensioner now, used to be an electrician. And when we got him on a slightly scratchy phone line this morning from Nicosia, he was still hopping mad.
My first reaction was anger. I don't think this action is correct. It will not correct the economy. It will create more problems. And I think it's a robbery, this kind of action.
Yeah. How much is it going to cost you? How much money are they going to take from you?
I think about between 3,000 and 4,000 euros.
Ooh, that's a lot of money.
Yes.
So are you going to line up whenever the banks open on Thursday or Friday? Are you going to line up and take the rest of your money out of the bank?
I cannot. Where would I take it to?
You could put it under your mattress.
Under the mattress. I'll think about it. I'll see how I'll get on. The bet it will be safer than having it in the bank.
Yeah. One more thing and then I'll let you go, Mr. Moiseos. Do you think there's anything you can do about this, or is this just going to happen and the government's going to do whatever it wants to do?
Well, the only thing I can do, I express my opinion and good friends and to the media and what else can I do?
Well, I think you just did it. Andreas Moisios, we reached him in Nicosia, Cyprus. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All right, so let's do a little what-if just to kind of bring this story home. Obviously, we're not as bad off as the Cypriots. We control our currency for one. Our economy is totally different and better for two. But still, how much of a bite would a Cyprus-style debt fix take out of your bank account? That's a question that pretty much screams, hey, I bet we could build a web thing to do that. So we did. Check out the calculator we came up with. It's at marketplace.org. At the aforementioned street corner in Lower Manhattan today, by the way, a hiccup, nothing more. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For those diligently keeping track of President Obama's second-term cabinet, there is a new name today. Thomas Perez, lead of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, has been nominated to be the new Secretary of Labor. Labor is, to be honest, one of those executive departments that's in the news pretty much once a month on Jobs Day, right? So from the Marketplace desk of keeping us all up to speed, here's Scott Tong to remind us what that person and that department actually does.
Let's pose the George Bailey question from It's a Wonderful Life. What if the Labor Department were never born? Clarence, the guardian angel, was unavailable at airtime, but Georgetown historian Michael Kazin was. He says workers wouldn't be protected against bosses paying us less than we've earned, or stealing from the 401k kitty, or working in unsafe conditions. And we all take this for granted.
Americans hate big government, but they're often very happy to get what big government gives them.
Kazin says the department began as a nod to organized labor in the Woodrow Wilson era.
In gratitude to support he was getting from Samuel Gompers and most of the labor movement in 1912, Wilson decides to grant organized labor a long-standing desire of organized labor, which is to have their own department.
Of course, employers and banks rely on the department's number crunchers, especially the employment stats. Now, every election year, the department is accused of playing politics with jobs numbers. But Pat O'Keefe, who worked at labor in the Reagan years, says impossible.
Even if somebody were to try, it would be such a complex undertaking as probably to surpass even the most Machiavellian among us.
That's not to say the department can improve. Former Labor Secretary Ray Marshall wants better data on why America has such a mismatch between jobs and job seekers.
We got jobs going unfilled, we're told, and we got workers who want jobs. Now, something's wrong if we're unable to organize ourselves to be able to have a better fit.
The Labor Department does have its haters, but historian Kazin doesn't think it would ever get eliminated, as some would like. It's been around so long, it's earned its wings. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One more Washington thing before we move on. It comes courtesy of ABC's This Week, yesterday morning. Martha Raddatz playing a piece of tape from President Obama and then asking a question of her guest yesterday, Speaker of the House John Boehner. Here you go.
So we don't have an immediate crisis in terms of debt. In fact, for the next 10 years, it's going to be in a sustainable place.
Is he right that we don't have an immediate crisis?
We do not have an immediate debt crisis. But we all know that we have one looming.
So first of all, what's up with those television sound effects? Always. But second of all, that whole sequester thing, they were just what? Kidding with that? All right, moving on. A multi-billion dollar national enterprise publicly acknowledged today that it is desperately in need of rebranding. Executives said they've got to expand their market appeal to young people, minorities, and women. They said their own focus groups describe them as scary and narrow-minded. We are not talking Fortune 500 here, as you might have guessed. It is the Republican Party instead. In the wake of last year's election, the GOP commissioned a formal soul-searching, a 100-page report it released today that reads not unlike a corporate manifesto full of marketing lingo and consumer data. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
The first rule of rebranding?
Never let people know that you've decided to rebrand.
Brand strategist Adam Hampt says rebranding should appear organic. As far as the GOP's image overhaul is concerned, that ship has sailed. So the second rule of rebranding?
Rebranding is not just a superficial layer. It has to go deep into the way a company operates.
Cautionary tale, the late Oldsmobile.
Probably one of the most memorable advertising campaigns of all time.
This is not your father's Oldsmobile.
Because it was a clever way to rebrand but the product never lived up to it.
One company that did it right is Nintendo, says Ira Kalb, a professor of marketing at USC. Nintendo had ruled the video game roost, but started losing market share to Sony and Microsoft.
So they decided to come up with a completely different type of a game, and they came out with Nintendo Wii.
Suddenly, Nintendo had a new niche. It made video games everyone could understand and use, and it promoted fitness. But there's a danger in rebranding, says consultant Deborah Kay, who's worked with companies like McDonald's, Apple, and Nissan.
If there's something loved and classic, they don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Case in point, the new Coke debacle of the mid-80s. Kay says Coke overlooked its real strength.
Coke represents deep American values. It's all, everything we grew up with. So when they put new Coke out there, they were saying, this is better.
Kay says a successful rebranding requires buy-in at all levels, employees, management, investors. Consensus could be a tricky formula for a political party. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Say what you will about air travel today, and boy, we all do, don't we? But here is one perhaps counterintuitive indicator. How bad can the airline industry be when so many people want to work in it? Take as just one example, Delta Airlines. It advertised for flight attendants not too long ago. 400 open positions, more than 50,000, 50,000 applications rolled in, which means statistically it's easier to get into Harvard than it is to snag a flight attendant gig at Delta. So what does it take, do you suppose, to be among the select few? We sent Jim Burris to find out.
A flight attendant's job isn't typical.
It's time to relax.
And at Delta, neither is the interview. Just consider the icebreaker that kicks off the day-long process.
Of all who have applied for this, we chose you. 50,000 applied.
A chorus line of uniformed flight attendants serenade a few dozen candidates who have made it this far. All this is taking place at Delta's corporate campus in a big room designed to look like an airport lounge. Think long couches and coffee tables. And there are some ground rules to get out of the way.
How many of you love people? Great. How many of you love to travel? Oh, great. So you've used that line already. You can't use that in the interview.
To become a Delta flight attendant, you have to impress current Delta flight attendants. That's because they do the interviews. They decide who makes the cut.
We know they're nervous.
Carmen Richardson is one. She's been with Delta 26 years. In that time, she's interviewed a lot of candidates, and she knows what to look for.
But even being nervous, through that nervousness, we ought to be able to see that they're warm and gracious, approachable, that they'd be willing to, let's say, after they've had a long day and there is a delay on the airplane, they're not going home, they're going to take care of customers for another 4 hours, that they would still be consistent and want to be warm and gracious.
Applicant Laura Long says she's got all that covered. The 38-year-old has already spent much of her adult life at Delta. From baggage service to ticketing to working the gates, she's done about every customer service job, except flight attendant.
Honestly, it's my dream job. It's my dream job. You can really change and make a wonderful experience for passengers.
But the job goes beyond making sure passengers are comfortable. Flight attendants are the first responders in an emergency. And in the post-9/11 airline world, they're also the last line of defense. But the perk of traveling for work has strong appeal. More people want to be a flight attendant today than ever before.
American Airlines has been advertising vacancies of 1,500 flight attendants, and they got 22,000 applications for those. U.S. Airways got about 20,000 applications for 420 vacancies, so it's not unique to Delta.
Joe Bellotti is president of AirlineCareer.com. He says stubbornly high unemployment is helping fuel the demand, and airline HR departments are scrambling to keep up with the flood of applications.
All right, bees, where are my bees?
Bees!
One time.
Back at Delta's headquarters, applicants are broken into three groups. One group heads into side rooms where two flight attendants interview each candidate. Based on their performance, one or two of them could walk away with a job offer. The majority won't. Breaking that news is tough, admits Delta flight attendant Troy Thorup.
One of the hardest things for me is, you know, you have to say goodbye at the end of the day to some of these candidates, and they're not going to get the position. And it's tough because I know what I have, and I wish they could have it too.
For those who do make it, they're guaranteed long hours, a physically demanding workday, and long periods away from home. And while wages have improved, the average flight attendant's annual pay hovers in the mid-30,000s. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Remember the good old days when families fought with each other on vacation and not with their dashboards?
My car, my enemy. But first, let's do the numbers. The sad music courtesy of Cyprus. Today, of course, the Dow Industrials gave back 62 points, about 0.4%, closed at 14,452. The NASDAQ slipped 11 points, a 0.3%, 3237. At the bell, the S&P 500 down 8 points. We'll call that a 0.5%, ended things at 1552. Financial shares led the way down. Morgan Stanley sagged 2.5%. Citigroup debited 2%. Today, Goldman Sachs shares ebbed 1.9%. On a day when a lot of stocks struggled to pare their losses, two recent laggards scored big. JCPenney surged more than 6% today after an analyst suggested the retailer turn many of its stores into real estate investments. That would be the Sears Roebuck strategy, I gather. Hewlett-Packard added nearly 3% after another analyst issued a buy recommendation. Europe, not so good. The FTSE in London down 0.5%. The French CAC 40 the same. Germany's DAX down 0.4%. All of that because of Cyprus. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for February. Purveyor of familiar and fantastic kitchen essentials, Williams-Sonoma reports quarterly earnings. And the U.S. Standard Time Act was passed on March 19, 1918, establishing time zones and daylight saving time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Used to be that getting a book published was practically a Herculean feat. Authors would shop their manuscripts around and around and then around some more. Now, it's almost as easy as pressing a button. Self-publishing is the in thing now, and lo and behold, it can be quite lucrative. Hugh Howey is Exhibit A. He's already sold 500,000 e-copies of his latest science fiction novel, Wool, revenues in the six figures, a huge percentage of which he gets to keep. And to boot, he has just signed a print-only deal with a big-name publishing house, Simon & Schuster. Hugh, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the business model here. I mean, you had this book, you had it out as an e-book, and you were essentially self-publishing, and the game has changed.
Yeah, it's, you know, you have access to readers all over the world now through their digital devices. So rather than finding success through a bookstore, I found success through bathrooms and living rooms, and word of mouth just exploded, and now I'm releasing a print book into bookstores with Simon & Schuster. It's pretty amazing.
Why the print book, though? Do you feel the need to do that? Is that like a validating thing somehow, or is it? Obviously, they're paying you for it, but I mean, what's the rationale?
Yeah, they're paying me for it. The rationale is readership. As a storyteller, I just want as many readers as possible. And if I wanted validation, I could have taken a lot more money from some other publishers and had the same bookstore penetration. But the print book was just not my primary source of income, and so I was willing to barter the print rights only and keep the digital rights. Mm-hmm. And that was the deal that we told would never happen, and we just kept turning down other offers until it did happen.
Yeah, let's make sure that point comes across. You own the digital rights to this book still, right? And those are you're betting and have been the lucrative ones.
And not only that, it gives me the control over pricing. I think ebooks should be cheaper than the mass market paperbacks that I grew up with, so I can serve my readers and keep my ebook price down where I feel like they should be as a consumer.
Yeah, and you get to keep all or some overwhelming percentage of it, right?
Yeah, I keep 70%. to compete with this. I believe publishers will eventually have to pay higher royalty rates than they do now.
Yeah, which is not far from blood from a stone, right?
Yeah, in some ways I understand where they're coming from, and I understand that there's a lot of overhead with the book in general. But as the market improves for ebooks and publishers are making more and more money with less overhead, I think there's going to have to be some sort of profit sharing with the author.
Yeah, it does kind of make sense. How many publishers did you turn down?
Oh, we've had at least a dozen offers over the last 12 or 14 months. The first round, they were offering six figures. And at that point, I was making that in 2 months. And then they were offering high six figures, and I'd be making that in several months. And then by the time they were offering seven figures, I'd already made seven figures.
Dude, you should have waited another couple of months, man.
Yeah. Well, but at some point, you've made enough money, and you get to make decisions based on appealing to your audience instead of just trying to maximize your earnings.
Which is the liberating thing about this whole deal, right?
It has changed everything.
Hugh Howey, his book is called Wool. It's available in actual book form. Hugh, thanks a bunch.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
Lego announced today it's building a new factory in China. Not, it says, for cheaper manufacturing. They just want to be closer to their Asian customers. Sales of those ubiquitous little blocks have been booming the past couple of years, while other toy companies are suffering, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
I mean, think about it. Lego sells plastic bricks in the age of the iPad. But they fly off store shelves, says Alexis Smith, a manager at Kidding Around, an independent toy store in New York. She says the store tries to stay away from stuff that's too mainstream, but
Lego's one of those things that you just can't not have. It's something that sells itself.
And it's starting to sell itself to a growing Asian middle class, says Sean McGowan, an analyst with Needham & Company.
As they have more spending power, alongside of that, they're also developing, you know, the inclination to spend that money on toys. They in a sense, they want to emulate the success of the West.
Licenses with movies like Star Wars and other entertainment brands have also been big for the company. And then there's Friends, Lego's new product marketed towards girls.
They were successful at capturing what it was that girls were interested in. And the name says it all. They're really interested in the relationships between the characters.
For an adult, it's easy to dismiss Legos as just some pieces of plastic. But the company is actually quite innovative, says Dave Robertson, the author of a forthcoming book on Legos. After almost going bankrupt in 2003 with lots of distracting side products, Lego decided to get back to the brick.
So what really keeps Lego going is their ability to tell stories around the bricks and construct, richly detailed toys.
Like ninjas that fight skeletons, one of their bestsellers. Because these days, actually anyone can make a brick. Lego's patents expired. And that makes all of this even more impressive. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Cars nowadays come equipped with virtually every bell and whistle one can think of. Collision avoidance systems, infotainment features, cameras and alarms, and interactive this's and that's, all designed to keep us safe and attract new customers, which is fine. It's great, even. Commentator Beth Titel, however, protests.
Remember the good old days when families fought with each other on vacation and not with their dashboards? But there we were in sunny Florida, cruising the highway at 62 miles per hour, when our rental car displayed a scolding message to drive at a safe speed. "Look around you," my fifth grader shouted at our sedan. "Everyone else is going faster." I frantically pressed the OK button on the steering wheel, hoping to make the safety warning disappear. But it stayed on and in my face. "We're on the highway," I yelled, modeling bad behavior in so many ways, I don't even want to go there. And people say texting is distracting. I know the car makers are trying to improve things or give buyers what they say they want. But along the way, the car has become its own backseat driver. The helicopter parent of the vehicular world, always nagging you to fill up or reminding you every 30 seconds that a right turn's coming or that there's a construction ahead and there might be a traffic jam. Some models sound chimes if a front seat passenger isn't buckled, even if that passenger is a heavy backpack. Others beep, beep, beep to warn you about a nearby obstacle, even when it's your neighbor's familiar fence. There are cars that shame owners for not driving in a fuel-efficient manner, and others that are such busybodies, they're sparking arguments between couples. I've heard about cars that require drivers to read a safety message before they start the car. Every single time. And if I'm already in my car, looking out the windshield at the falling snow, do I really need the dashboard to tell me a storm's underway? Given all this, the findings of a study by J.D. Powers and Associates are not surprising. While cars have gotten better overall, the 2012 study found, complaints about audio, entertainment, and navigation systems have increased by 45% since 2006. Meanwhile, as the cars get ever bossier, here's a question. Is there a name for road rage that's turned inward toward your own vehicle?
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. No idea what she drives, by the way.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that it was 23 years ago today that somebody walked out of Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum with $500 million worth of art tucked under their arms. It is widely regarded as one of history's biggest art heists, and I mention it because today the FBI said in a press conference they know who did it. But they're not going to tell us. They do say they think at least part of the haul was fenced in Philadelphia, but that the statute of limitations has run out for the original thieves, which is kind of ironic. I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 62 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 11 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 down 8 points, about 0.5%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.